The Eldred v. Reno case, which is currently on appeal to the D.C. Circuit after a quick and relatively painless loss in the district court below, being argued this Thursday by Larry Lessig. And we organized a session around this to help prepare the actual case as it will be argued on Thursday. So we have Larry here arguing, playing himself in this role. And Richard Emery, a prominent civil rights lawyer from New York City, has agreed to come up and shill for the government. And I see that Eric Saltzman is his second chair. We also have a distinguished panel of judges, Professor Barron, Professor Fried, Professor Fisher, who have agreed to grill and give hell to the respective parties as a way of giving help to them. So with that, we thought we would extend the time slightly so as to get a little more question and discussion in from what it will be in the D.C. Circuit on Thursday, giving 25 minutes to each side, and Larry can allocate some portion of that to rebuttal if he chooses. Claire and Chris have agreed to manage the time cards. They're probably off in the corner preparing the time cards right now. There they are. And then maybe afterwards, we're all family, can feel free to give some impressions or something. It's an educational opportunity as well as a working session. So with that, thank you all for being here, and if our timekeepers are ready, we might as well get started. Larry, do you know how much time you want for rebuttal? He reserves 5 minutes for rebuttal. So with that, I defer to the Chief Justice, who can get us started.
Mr. Lessig, we'll hear from you, please.
Let me say out of role, first of all, I'm grateful to you for doing this. This is actually much harder, I think, than the argument on Thursday will be, both because...
This isn't part of this plan.
Both because I know and respect your judgments more frequently, and I feel less prepared now than I hope to be prepared on Thursday. So with those caveats, let me begin with the argument. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The question in this case is whether the constraints authored by the framers in the Constitution, both in the Copyright Clause and in the First Amendment, apply to Congress's efforts to extend the terms of copyrights. Plaintiffs represent a wide range of individuals and organizations who rely upon the public domain for their livelihood. Congress in 1998 passed a statute, the Copyright Term Extension Act, which extended both retrospectively and prospectively the terms of copyright by 20 years. Plaintiffs were adversely affected by that action and will be in the future by the prospective extension as well. Now, it's important to understand the sense in which they are affected, and this can be divided into two separate kinds of harms. First is the obvious harm, that public domain works, which otherwise would have been available to them, are not available to them, and they therefore will have to pay...
Mr. Lessig, I just want to get this clear, perhaps I don't understand. No work which has actually entered the public domain is withdrawn from it by this statute, is it?
That's right, Your Honor. This statute stops works from 1923 on from entering the public domain. So, for example, Robert Frost's New Hampshire would have been available to the lead plaintiff in this case, Eric Eldred, to publish on his website as a public domain work, but for this statute. And other plaintiffs...
Would have been available... Again, I'm not clear. I just want to be sure that I understand it. It had not yet entered the public domain at the time the statute was enacted.
That's right. This statute does not withdraw objects from the public domain. It simply prevents them from falling into the public domain under the terms of the copyright grant as amended by Congress.
And in this respect, is it different from various extensions which Congress has passed since, I believe, 1831?
In this respect, it's not, Your Honor, at least formally, although the extent of the term of copyright now distinguishes the length of the extension in this case from earlier extensions. Under the government's analysis of why there's some legitimate interest here, that's plausible when the extension is short to a short term.
Even for retroactive extension?
No, we would argue it's not plausible for retroactive extensions in either case.
Again, this is perhaps my confusion that these words are being bandied about. What do you mean by a retroactive extension? You mean works that have already been written?
Right. For works that are already copyrighted and whose term was set at the time the work was either published or affixed in a tangible medium, that term has been extended by the CTEA.
Mm-hmm.
And for works which have not yet been authored, the term offered under the Copyright Act has been extended by the CTEA.
So what prevents your argument from, in fact, invalidating all extensions, at least all, as you're using the term, retroactive extensions, all the way back to 1831, is this is too long while the others were short enough. Is it something like that?
Well, we've argued, although this issue has not been briefed because the government has not raised the question of earlier extensions in the way that this...
I think they advert to it when they say that yours is an argument that proves too much. I think that, I suppose, is their way of...
Right. So they clearly say, and it is true, that Congress has extended the term of copyright in earlier times in a way which also extended the term to what we're calling retrospective extensions. But let's put that in context. In the first 100 years, Congress extended the term of copyright once. In the next 50 years, Congress extended the term of copyright once again. And in the last 38 years, Congress extended the term of copyright now 11 separate times.
Mm-hmm.
And so to the extent there is some argument about a pattern or practice which the government has made which justifies this behavior, it must point only to very recent extensions. And we submit that that's not a sufficient justification to overcome any constitutional problem that such extensions create.
That may be. I'm just asking a different kind of thing. What would be the implication of our agreeing with your argument? How many of those 11 extensions in the last 38 years would also have to fall? Because one has to think about that. You know, will you be back next year with the others?
Well, Your Honor, we haven't taken a position on whether the rule that you would announce must be applied retrospectively to each of these extensions, in particular because of the substantial reliance interest that would have been built into the existing extension surviving for a significant amount of time. So we believe there would be a significant question raised about the retrospective effect of your judgment in this particular case. In any case, that issue has not been briefed or raised by the government directly about the issue of the retrospective application of your rule. So we have not addressed that in our brief, and believe that's something that must be addressed.
By retrospective, you mean applicable to other statutes than this statute?
That's right. Applicable to the 1976 statute and to each of the interim extensions from 1962 on. And at least in principle, although we don't believe it would have that effect, the 1909 statute and the 1831 statute.
Thank you.
So I take it then that the length of this extension isn't relevant. It's only the fact that there's been a retrospective extension.
The length of this extension is not relevant for purposes of the copyright clause claim that we're making. The length of the extension is relevant for purposes of the First Amendment claim that we're making. And to the extent the government makes a claim that extending a term, even a retrospective term, creates some present incentives, that's more plausible in the case where the extension is to a short term than it is plausible when the extension is to an already extended term. So in the 1831 case, Congress extended the renewal term retrospectively. It extended the initial term retrospectively. This would apply to existing authors who were, in that time, actually producing works. They would get a windfall from our perspective, but they still were existing authors. In the current case, This is an extension which is being applied to people who are not authors. They're being applied to heirs of these initial authors, 70 years after they initially produced their work.
And why should that matter for purposes of giving incentives to produce?
Well, of course, under our argument, retrospective extensions don't create incentives. The government has suggested that retrospective extensions, in fact, do create some speculative amount of increase in incentives. All that I'm saying is, if that argument is true, it is one way to distinguish the shorter extensions from the later extensions, although we're going to argue that, in fact, the argument's not true. So,
let's explore that point for a minute, because it seems critical to your analysis, the plausibility of the government's claim that a retroactive extension of the term would stimulate kinds of work that so, this analogy occurred to me, reading your brief, is think about private employers and the way in which they deal with employees. Companies commonly offer their employees rewards in, roughly speaking, one of three forms: salary, they pay them for their work, or there are slices of the equity of the company, stock options, and there are bonuses come at the end of the year. Now, each of the first two seems a quite plausible way of providing incentives to engage in work that benefits the company. The third is not so obviously connected to incentives because it's discretionary on the part of the company, and it's ostensibly a reward for stuff in the past, but a discretionary bonus distributed at the end of the year to avoid it. Now, even though the talk of a bonus, the justification of a bonus is typically in the mode of thanks very much for what you did in the past, here's a gift. Many companies think about their bonus programs in different terms. They think of them as a way of stimulating activity by their employees. Roughly speaking, it's here's something that expresses our respect for you, our gratitude, and an assurance that you'll be treated well in the future. Now, why can't Congress's behavior here in retroactively giving to authors and movie studios and so forth an extension which they are not currently entitled be construed the same way? Why can't it, in other words, figure as a kind of incentive, just as a kind of reward bonus that law firms could distribute at the end of the year is understood by the law firms as a kind of incentive?
Your Honor, to answer that, I think we have to ask the question, in which context are we evaluating any potential incentive? If it's under the first, and the question is different, it seems to me, if it's being evaluated under the First Amendment claim or under the copyright claim. If it's evaluated under the First Amendment claim, then in our view, intermediate scrutiny is appropriate here, and while it's possible that one imagines some increase in incentive here, the question is whether it's substantial enough to overcome the substantial cost of free speech. That requires a weighing under the O'Brien test, which the lower court did not do, and the government does not argue in this case.
Is this, to your knowledge, the first time that the O'Brien test has been invoked? Well, I think I'll let you answer my brother's question first, but I'm not am concerned about this.
If it's evaluated under the copyright clause case, copyright clause, then in our view, the way the court has analyzed the copyright clause is to ask not some abstract question about incentives, but whether this qualifies as an original work for purposes of the copyright clause. And now we ask this court to interpret the meaning of limited times in the same way that they've interpreted the meaning, the Supreme Court has interpreted the meaning of original in the copyright clause. And under those interpretations, then the question of the speculative benefit would be weighed against the meaning of whether this satisfies the copyright clause.
So you're suggesting there's U.S. Supreme Court precedent for this kind of inquiry under the copyright clause?
Well, there's certainly Supreme Court precedent for the establishing of the standard of originality. Right? The Supreme Court has held in Feist and in the trademark cases before that for something to be subject to the copyright power, it must be, quote, original. Now, original doesn't appear in the text of the Constitution. Original is an implied term that the court has found from understanding the meaning of authors and writings in light of the purpose of the clause to promote progress.
Was the court in those cases making an explicitly constitutional decision, or was it interpreting the trademark and copyright statutes in the light of what it assumed was the constitutional background, so that, you have been saying, had the Congress gone against their judgment, then the statute would have been unconstitutional. Those cases don't go that far, do they?
Well, certainly Feist is dicta for the purposes that I'm offering it here. Feist says that there is a constitutional dimension to this inquiry, and then elaborates for a large segment of the opinion what the constitutional dimension is, and raising quite an uncontroversial point that originality is a requirement under the copyright clause. But in the trademark cases, the court expressly was holding that the copyright clause would not justify the trademark act, that it was outside of the scope of the copyright clause, primarily because, as the court said, trademark is often simply the protection of something that's already in existence. And because it's already in existence, it can't therefore be original for purposes of the copyright clause, and therefore it's outside the scope of the copyright clause.
And is based on other powers of Congress.
In that case in particular, the court deferred the question of whether it would survive under the Commerce Clause, and subsequently is upheld under the Commerce Clause, but not in this case. So the issue of whether this survives under originality, then, depends on whether we can view the copywriting, or extension of the term of a copyright for an existing work as, quote, original, in the way the court has expressed that. Now, the government has in its brief conceded that there can be no copyright extended to works that have fallen into the public domain. And it has conceded this quite wisely because the Supreme Court has indicated that twice in the context of patents, and in the definition of original in the context of Feist expressly said the original means, originality means also that something's not in the public domain. But if Congress can't extend something to extend copyright to something in the public domain, what principle explains why it cannot? In the government's justification for this statute, the very same justifications would exist for extending copyright to works in the public domain. They could plausibly, for the same reasons that Justice Fried has raised, create incentives for other people to work. But the court has said, and the government cited the court saying this, that the purpose clause of the copyright clause, when it says promote, means to create an incentive, to induce the creation of something else. And what this court has articulated as original cannot include within it the extension of a copyright term for something which is already in existence any more than it can create a copyright now for something that is in the public domain. Something which would have been perfectly copyrightable prior to its publishing or being placed in the public domain, but by virtue of it being in existence and in the public domain, it is no longer copyrightable because it's not
really
original.
Really, the strongest authority, and it's pretty good, the strongest authority for your, direct authority for your proposition is your adversary's own concession.
Yes, that's right, Your Honor.
Has that been the court's argument, Mr. Lessig, as to why you can't withdraw something from the public domain?
The court has just expressly stated in the patent clause context why you can't remove something from the public domain. And the argument,
constitutional holding, or?
In the explication of the patent, the constitutional power under the patent clause, the court has said that the purpose of the patent clause and copyright clause by direct application is to extend and protect the public domain here, and to remove something from the public domain would not, in the context of the Graham case at least, be constituted as a patent being granted to something new or novel, which is the analogous or parallel limitation to the originality limitation in the context of copyright.
question is relevant, it's not going to be immediately obvious, but could Congress, suppose that we disagree with you, but Congress is persuaded that they made a mistake in this statute, and next month, a few months from now, they repeal this statute. Any constitutional problem?
Yeah, great question. So the issue is, has there been vested rights here that have been created by the copyright clause that can't be eliminated? Yeah, just the sort of thing Terry Fisher would ask. Can't answer that, Your Honor. If I may, let me just touch briefly on...
The government has argued that there isn't a fact versus matter exception. That so long as the Copyright Act protects fair use, there can be no First Amendment issue raised about a particular statute's relationship to First Amendment reliance on the Copyright Act. Every case the government relies upon to make this assertion, the case where the challenge is to the use made of an existing and legitimate copyright by a copyright holder, in refusing to allow the claimant access to its copyright right. So it is analogous to a claim for a First Amendment right to trespass. The court has rightfully rejected the First Amendment right to trespass. But in none of these cases has the court been addressing the general question, not of the use of a particular copyright, but of the statute that's modifying a term of the Copyright Act. Our claim is that statute must be evaluated under ordinary First Amendment analysis.
And not where our own precedent in Schnapper and Poland does not apply.
It clearly is not right now. In Schnapper, the issue, as the court stated, was whether the appellant had a constitutional right, a First Amendment right, to use without compensation the copyrighted works of the defendant. And the claim and the court said there is no First Amendment right to do that. There was in Schnapper an issue that approached our issue. The court expressly said for standing reasons it was not addressing that issue. So Schnapper is precisely in line with this issue. And the same thing in my opinion. Any of you can answer the question.
Thank you very much. May it please the court, Richard Emery for the United States. I beg to differ with my counsel, my adversary. The question of strains in this case is one not of what he expects of the copyright law, not of the copyright clause, not of the First Amendment. It's a question of the proper exercise of congressional power. Once the appellants concede that Congress may, as the copyright clause says, for limited terms grant exclusive rights to authors and inventors, then the question is, on what basis may Congress do so? And the basis that Congress may do so is plainly when it acts rationally, when its goals are connected to its means. The problem here is that the real issue framed beyond what Congress may do in the copyright context is what this court may do in the copyright context. This is really as much a separation of powers case as it is a copyright, or First Amendment, or congressional powers case. Because what the appellants are advocating,
every case we were asked to declare an act of Congress is beyond its powers.
That is absolutely correct. But when you have, as the court has had many times before, a separation of powers case in the context of Congress, an act of Congress being declared unconstitutional, what do you require? What does this court or any court require? They don't require abstract precepts, assumptions from Boston, Massachusetts, and the Harvard Internet Center about the way that free expression is fostered in society, about the way the arts are promoted under the copyright laws. What you require, especially as an appellate court, is a record, a factual record of findings based on contested facts, based on a trial, based on both individual personal testimony and expert testimony, which reaches findings that then may or may not convince you And that Congress has acted.
We have no such record.
We have no such record here.
Right, but that's because because you succeeded in the law on a motion to dismiss.
Well, but the problem here is that the way this case is framed, there was a cross motion for summary judgment, and it's working not on the basis that all facts have to be taken as true, but as I read the record, it's before you in the context of your having to make a decision about whether these precepts, many of which are very debatable, to say the least, ones about
sanctuary. And would we even think if we denied the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment, but also deny your motion to dismiss?
No, I think we should prevail on our motion to dismiss, and I will go on to point out this reason, but at a minimum, this case must go back for a trial. At a very minimum, a factual record to controvert the unfounded speculations and precepts which are the basis of the appellant's case must be made before this court can act, at a minimum. And at a maximum, and we think it's very clear that no rational approach to the way that these precepts and these ideas can be evaluated would support them. Just look at the things.
Jerry, what do you have to show in order to be justified? What should we do again?
Well, the necessary and proper clause, and this court has looked at it, Stewart versus Aiden, which was a Supreme Court case, and also Schnapper looked at the question as well. The question is, under the necessary and proper clause, has Congress adopted reasonable means to achieve a valid end? And in this case, we know the framers have essentially said that copyright is the engine of expression.
So this is an argument. This is an argument to address the claim that this is beyond Congress's power under the copyright clause. But what about the plaintiff's claim that even if it were, the First Amendment comes after the copyright clause, and to that extent the copyright clause is subject to the First Amendment, and perhaps is disciplined by it more severely than we would be able to do under ordinary rational basis review.
Well, as you know, several courts have rejected, in United Video in this court, have rejected the notion that copyrighted material, that challenges to the use of copyrighted material can be supported by a First Amendment claim. But more to the point, I think, is the fact that if you think about it, the standards collapse on one another, I would argue. I would argue that the O'Brien test is not applicable in this situation because you have two competing forms of expression where the O'Brien test has never been applied before. As far as we are aware, you have two competing forms of expression here, the advocates of the public domain, and on my side, in this particular case, advocates for extending and appropriately capturing copyright for those who create works. When two forms of expression of this sort are in the competition with one another, you have a very different standard, and you have to stand.
Well, I'm not sure I understand the premise. The copyright doesn't affect the extent to which the authors whom the rights are extended can sue. I mean, the movie studios or the book authors on whose behalf this statute was ostensibly adopted can speak or not, regardless of whether they're given copyright protection.
That's right.
So the copyright only acts to restrict speech. It never acts to protect speech.
But the competing policy underpinnings of copyright are to engender a society in which expression is protected. Ideas, of course, are free to anyone to avail themselves of the First Amendment. Ideas are different. This is a form of expression which is owned and which other people cannot copy. That's the limit. It's a very limited thing of copyright, as you know. They can use all the ideas underlying it. They can even use variants. They just can't exactly copy it. That's what was restraining here.
Right.
They're derivative rights in the form, exactly. But the fact of the matter is, it's not like patent. where an idea or a method, a whole range of things, is taken out of the public domain.
Well, increasingly a lot of it happens. So for example, you can't make a storyline, you can't adopt characters presented in a film, Mickey Mouse, for example, though it's copyright protection.
Well, there's disputes about that, but the fact of the matter is, as intellectual property is protected, it's the narrowest form of protection, one could easily argue. And in that sense, it is taken out of the public domain for the purpose of stimulating expression, for creating incentives. In fact, this is really one of the main points here. If you look at the copyright laws, it says promote science and useful arts. It doesn't say to create an incentive for authors. That's an interpretation that my opponents have come to and tried to narrow it in. Yes, certainly creating an incentive for authors is one of the reasons that the framers wanted the copyright laws, but to create an environment, to create a free society, to create a way of that people's originality and people's creativity would be incentive.
Do you acknowledge that the limited time is a limitation that judges could enforce against the public?
I acknowledge that limited times have limits. And I will say, however, that we do not make a concession, and I think you can look at our brief and see that we do not make a concession that Mr. Lessig, or Professor Lessig, has said we made. In fact, in Section 104 of the Copyright Act, the amendments in 1994, certain works of art from foreign that were under foreign copyright that were in the public domain in the United States were recaptured by the amendments to the 1994 Copyright Act. In fact, I would argue
that have been tested before.
That's not contested.
And it is, so it's your position that I'm thinking of my daughter's example of the bonus and so on, and you know, other reasons why you might act retroactively, look back and say, oh my goodness, this is an injustice. We really ought to correct this. We should have done it the first time, but we now see that it created a gap and we better correct it. So if Congress saw some such gap and decided to withdraw matter from the public domain, you think that might also be at least arguably.
I have the answers to that. Yes, that's the first answer. The second answer is, I think Congress could create a copyright scheme where everything was in the public domain for a short period of time, and then people would apply. If it became popular, they could make money on it as a way of promoting it. It's possible that they would see that. Congress would see that as the way to best promote sciences and useful.
So there's no constitutional matter out of the bag.
I don't think there's any constitutional. I think that there are a number of ways Congress can approach this issue of promoting science and the useful arts. That is the underlying policy here. We all agree on that.
You know, that's the limit of time. If you can see it can't be a million years.
I can see it can't be a million years.
Now, and what are we to do with the possibility of Congress will live in 10 years from now, but constantly over 7 years?
Well, let me answer your question narrowly and then more broadly. Narrowly, the simple fact is, major change in extension came in 1976. That was the watershed. As we know, up to that point, extensions were always for fixed time periods. In 1976, Congress decided that extensions would be for the life of the author plus 50 years. What they decided simply in 1998, the 50 years is not the full policy for which they had decided in 1976 to do this, namely to have it for life plus one more generation. They decided to add 20 years because it meant one more generation. And they also decided to add to the works for hire category another 20 years because of all these new media, which could then be exploited by generating more money under a longer copyright and providing resources to even marginal types of art.
What
are
the 20 years then? Well,
it depends on the policy that things are. If life expectancy dramatically increases, then increases may very well be appropriate. Because incentives ought to exist for people who write and create for themselves and their future generations. That is the general environment in which people are incented to create. So yes, there may be future extensions, and there may be a determination that because of the internet, because of new media, public domain becomes much more important than it is viewed now. And maybe, perhaps Congress and maybe others will bring to bear on Congress information, which will cause Congress to realize that a climate and environment of free expression is in fact created by shortening copyright. These are issues that are constituted delicate bounds, so Congress has to make difficult, complicated judgments based on all kinds of competing interests, not the least of which is the Harvard point of view, not the worst of which is the Polygon point of view. That's where this happens. This does not happen in courts. This happens in Congress. Unless this court can fix upon, and I don't believe Congress has done so, some specific, narrow, invalidating basis for this enactment. Well, I disagree. I think that if limited in Congress, if Congress stated that a 500-year copyright for all works would exist, I think that this court would be perfectly appropriate to say that Congress has read the limited times section out of the copyright clause, because that's not a limited time. But under the present state of knowledge and the present circumstances of human creative activity. But certainly at 20 years when they believed, when they made a finding that they made a mistake in 1976 because they wanted to give it the author's generation plus one more generation, is not appropriate. You don't need to face that question in this case. And I can see to you that there would be some level of extension which would be too long and unconstitutional in violation of the limited times clause. But that's not the issue here. We're not even close to that issue because what we have is hearing. If they were serious about attacking the copyright laws, they would have to attack the 1976 watershed change that occurred. But that's not what's happening here.
As I heard Mr. Lessig, I think he would not shrink from that.
Well, why didn't they do it? They can do it right here. They could have framed this case that way. That's another case. That's not this case. All this case is a tinkering with the 1976 statute that where Congress essentially said that it made a mistake, that it should have gone the full length of what is expected to be a life after the author's life. And it seems to me Congress has an absolute right to do that, even at the expense. And you see,
the statute, yes. How do you deal the plaintiff's argument about O'Brien, because I read O'Brien and the words which they put before us in the brief seems to cover this, and it seems to demand intermediate scrutiny, both as to the end and the means. You're arguing rational basis on both scores. How do you square that?
How
can we dispose of O'Brien, which we're bound by, of course, under the High Court?
We treated O'Brien one way in briefs, and I will describe that in answer to your question, and I can even argue beyond what the briefs say in answer to your question. And that is, in the briefs, that we cited the authority that O'Brien is not applied, and the lower court cited the authority to support that. Face the question before and decided that ideas versus expression, that dichotomy between ideas versus expression distinguishes O'Brien, distinguishes the underlying policies of the First Amendment claim in the copyright context. That, I think, is found in reason.
That's not the Supreme Court reason.
The Supreme Court does not take this issue.
The Supreme Court, in terms of ideas and expression in other contexts, I'm thinking of Cohen against California and Monte Grande.
Yes.
They absolutely rejected the notion that since you could have said this in another more polite way, you're protected. No, the form of the expression is just as protected as the idea. Well, perhaps that might be fair enough.
Well, I understand the point, but I would say beyond the answer to that we put out forth in the briefs, which is to simply say that First Amendment does not apply to copyright because of this dichotomy, because of the prior case law. I say that this standard of congressional findings and the underlying nature of the evidence that Congress based its decision on in this case easily meets the intermediate standard of review. I think that there are any number of bases that, see what you have here, Judge Friedman. What you have here is a very basic challenge to the fundamental notion inherent in the copyright clause, inherent in 200 years of the manner in which Congress and our society has stimulated creativity through rewarding it monetarily for length of time set by clause. You have that theory of the engine of creativity on the one hand versus this notion that the public domain has all of a sudden become somehow extra important beyond its prior importance, beyond the importance, of course, that the framers put to it, beyond the importance of any notion of public domain because of the internet, because of the new media, because of new ways of looking at creativity. That those two competing interests are by no means clear who's right. It's not at all clear. Congress certainly has the right. In fact, they are compelled to make a judgment between these two arguments of what creates the most expression in a free society. They have chosen the copyright view, which is embedded for 200 years in the way they've created. We don't suffer too much in this country from a lack of creativity or a lack of free expression. We're the best in the world. So the question is, why all of a sudden should the public domain, which is a mess of information, where nobody knows what to exploit, where nobody knows what to read, where nobody knows what to promote, because the incentives are minimal, really. I mean, the plaintiffs here do it for altruistic reasons only. And most of them aren't making any money on it at all. The point is, are we going to allow people to make money by owning intellectual property like this and stimulate expression that way? Or are we going to do it another way? I don't think they have proven in any way, shape, or form that the public domain is superior to the model of copyright. And therefore, at this juncture at least, intermediate scrutiny is more than satisfying. It's based on history, it's based on success, it's based on everything that we hold dear about creativity in our society. Why jeopardize it?
So this, your characterization of a non-theory, which is a case of right, seems to imply that copyright has developed a stable for a sustained period of time. New technology arises, and that prompts a sudden attack by complainants on this stable system, which has done us so much good, attempting to shrink the zone of property protection on behalf of a newly energized or appreciated public domain. But really what's going on is quite the opposite. It's true there's new technology which intensifies public interest and judicial interest in cases of this sort. But the legal situation is that the zone occupied by copyright has been expanded dramatically over the past 50 years. So here's my concern with the way in which you characterize the case, and particularly the emphasis you place on the word tinkering, is that if we address every one of these challenges deferentially, recognizing Congress's superior information gathering capability, and defer to their judgment, the cumulative effect of our deference on front after front after front is that copyright will overwhelm the zone of public domain. So conventional wisdom has for a very long time. Conventional wisdom not captured in one case, but an accumulation of Supreme Court cases and our cases, has seen compatibility between the First Amendment and copyright as residing in four propositions. One is the limited time, which separates the zone of property from non-property. Next is the originality requirement. Third is the idea-expression distinction, that only ideas are protected, only expressions are protected, not ideas. And the last is the fair use doctrine. On three of those four fronts, Congress has moved or is now moving significantly so as to expand the zone of property and shrink the zone of public domain. Here we have, of course, one of the four fronts that involves time. Fair use, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, significantly shrinks as a practical matter the zone of fair use by empowering the developers of information to encrypt it and then seek the aid of the federal courts to prevent others from unlocking it, regardless of whether copyright protection extends to those materials or regardless of the existence of a fair use defense if it arose at the copyright case. And finally, the idea expression distinction and the originality distinction are currently under assault in Congress with the development of two statutes, which in different degrees protect databases against encroachments. Databases of the sort that the Supreme Court advised decided were not entitled to copyright protection. So what we see here, the overall scene, is not the zone of copyright law being stable, and the plaintiffs, among others, seeking to shrink it on behalf of the public domain. It's rather copyright law is, in many fronts, growing and growing and growing. And if we, in this case, adopt a deferential posture, as you recommend, recognizing Congress's authority to tinker, and we do it in each of these other dimensions as well, haven't we abandoned our responsibility to shield the public interest, shield the First Amendment against Congress's authority under Article 1?
The two things I would say to that. First of all, in this case, I would argue to you that you must be deferential because there is no showing that the public domain will substitute or will somehow mitigate or change the notion that you have said, even if you're right about expansion of copyright.
Should the public be allowed to make such a showing?
They may well be able to make such a showing. I doubt it, but it's possible.
If you prevail, you're supporting a motion to dismiss.
We are supporting a motion to dismiss. The fact of the matter is it may very well be that they should make such a showing before the Congress, because that's where this issue belongs. And that's the second point. The second point, to your question, Judge Fisher, is that it's a very interesting notion about the attacks to bolster the copyright, expand the copyright. And you probably are correct in some overall sense about the expansion of copyright protection. And the question is, what is the result? What do we have? We have a society in which there is so much expression, much of it copyrighted, more than ever before. It's hard to say that substitution of large amounts of public domain material would enhance that, or would somehow organize it, or would somehow increase the value of the information we have. I don't see that. I don't see anybody arguing that in a coherent way. There may be an argument to that effect, but it's sort of some kind of religious notion almost. It's intuitive at best. Let somebody show it to us in congressional writing order, at least a little bit. I think the basic points have been made here. I think that the one thing I would say more directly to the points that are argued by the appellants, because they seem to hinge their arguments on two major points, and that is retrospective extensions, not creating the appropriate incentive for an author who is now dead. I think there are two points that this court should take into account, because it really is very much at the heart of the argument by the accounts. And that is that I think it's much more than what the authors themselves are incented that Congress is allowed to address with the clause. It is generally to promote progress, to create environment. The bonus idea is one that I think is apt and perhaps is one where you can imagine in more concrete, more day-to-day terms, the environment that's created by these kinds of retrospective incentives. I think that also you have to think of the retrospective application of the extension in terms of generating the flow of revenue. Yes, some author's children may be spending money in the Caribbean, but that's the price you pay for digitizing old movies and creating value in old copyrights that can be sold to other entities where they wouldn't have been sold before and capitalized upon by those entities when they would have just been lost in the mix from the past. The originality requirement, which is so heavily relied upon by counsel for appellants, is, I think, also a false argument here in the way that it is made. Of course, the copyright depends on originality to qualify for copyright. But their argument proves too much. Because if originality were a criteria for extensions, then no extensions would be legal. And they don't take the position that no extensions would be legal. They just take the position that this last 20-year extension would be legal. Certainly, the 1976 extension would be, if originality at the time of extension were the issue, would be very suspect. And I don't think that there's any reason to say that Congress can't change
the question. It would be, perhaps, say, next.
Well, that may be their next case, and if they're litigating incrementally, that may be a strategy that this court should take into account in thinking about where the limits are of its rule.
Well, I just must take into account that my thought is going to be Congress is legislating each amendment.
That's right. And I think there are ways to balance interests here, but they're certainly not with a 20-year extension after 1976. Thank you very much.
Your Honor, the issue here is standard of review. Lots of weight in the hands of how things could possibly have some kind of effect, but the government is not yet focused on the issue of standard of review as it applies in the copyright context and in the domestic context. In the copyright context, they say that O'Brien has never applied in the context where there's competing speech interests. That's just not the case. In San Francisco Arts and Athletics, where the court addressed the question of whether the Olympic Association forbidden use of the term gay Olympics, the court clearly conceived of this as a conflict between two speech interests. The court said,
I think that was a good point in your brief. I would throw a couple of other cases, the AP case, the application of the antitrust laws to a newspaper and going against the powers of communication out of that book. I don't recall, I don't recall the Iran as being applied yet, and I don't recall Indonesian scrutiny. I think they just said, this is a contract case, this is an antitrust case, the fact that it happens to be a newspaper doesn't matter.
That's right, Your Honor, but as the court said in Turner Broadcasting, in cases where there's general applicability of general law, a contract isn't intermediate scrutiny. As the court went on to say, whenever a law targets the press or affects the press, then there is always heightened review. And that's all we're asking for here, the ordinary review of heightened review.
What is the source of power which has how much time is allowed?
It's a copyright. That is the Commerce
Clause. There's no requirement in order to exercise commerce power that Congress take account of the public domain. But now here, Congress is exercising power pursuant to the copyright law. And if you're right, part of your express obligation is to take into account that consideration.
That's right.
Isn't that a kind of double counting on top of the requirement to take into the public domain and exercise the copyright power? They now have to consider it again in the public domain pursuant to that. That doesn't run any of the other overwhelming cases that you consider. Even San Francisco case, the source of power there was not one that the government wanted to be. To even exercise that power, first had to take account of public domain in order to exercise that power.
That's right. But the copyright clause, and this is the central point of this case, is different from every other power clause. It is the only clause that expressly states what its purpose must be in exercising.
But just on the first amendment,
just on the power clause. This is a limitation of
power. Just on the First Amendment point, though, in order to get the First Amendment issue, you would assume you'd have to show that Congress properly exercised the copyright power. And in order to properly exercise the copyright power, they would have already had to do the creation of whether the public domain was properly being considered. That's something that doesn't occur in any other type of case in which you've been in First Amendment review.
That's right. But the public domain we're asserting must be considered only in copyright clause context. In the First Amendment context, it's an ordinary review.
But
what you're
asking Congress to have done is they wouldn't have done under the copyright clause. They have to satisfy important government interest. What's that? The very one that you identify that they have to satisfy in order to exercise the copyright clause. How close to the one that interest does it have to be? Why not exactly those that have to be under the copyright clause?
Well, we do believe that these are mirror requirements, and that the purpose being set in the copyright clause does control legitimate purposes before being recognized in the analysis of this Amendment. But these are two independent ways of seeing that there must be heightened review here. And there must be heightened review in relationship to what my brother said, precisely because the Copyright Clause only protects the public domain.
Could you take a moment to address your brother's claim, the senator's claim, that by heightened review we can do that?
He
said that if it's intermediate scrutiny, no problem.
Well, the government has not argued in the recent case that this satisfies intermediate scrutiny, and we have not been given the opportunity the term requires to test whether, in fact, Congress made plausible judgments drawn from reasonable evidence about the effect of their statute on the incentives to produce new work, which is the core requirement as expressed by the Purpose Clause and the Copyright Clause. Now, just look at the structure of the Copyright Clause. It is Congress' power to create copyright. It doesn't mandate that Congress create copyright. The only requirement is that if Congress creates copyright, it must preserve the public domain, because the requirement is those copyrights must be fairly determined. So the only thing that's constitutionalized here is that there will be a public domain. Now, through a series of actions that Congress has taken for the last 38 years, it has consistently resisted that constitutional requirement. And all we are asking is that this Court look at the text and structure and original understanding of that clause and realize its obligation is to preserve the public domain, which is exactly what Congress is insisting.
Thank you. Well, discussion of this.
So, Mr. Senator,
we're all.
Can you use your microphone, sorry.
Sure.
I go through your AP and. Conan answer was very good, and I think you ought to make that is very, very important. And I didn't see it in the briefs. I don't know that it was important. Your biggest problem is an argument that proves too much, because why this shouldn't on that law go back to 1976 or well beyond its. All of those retroactive, I don't think you really put us at ease in the matter. The court's going to wonder exactly what are we getting into, and I'm not sure I know what you can say on that score. That's a real worry. And I just bet that's you're going
to be getting very far. Do you think there's a way objectively to distinguish from the standpoint of the rules governing retroactive application of constitutional doctrine? I mean, I know Scalia is in the least distinguished. But you would think that the other justices at least would be much more moved by the substantial.
I see. Your answer is. That there are vested rights on all of those, and this is it. Of course, when was this act passed?
1998.
We got 2 years with the vested rights.
Well, but we filed suit the very first moment we went into
the case. Okay, so that's a good answer. Do you think that's something he ought to stick with?
We stick with in the sense of conceit that they're not challenging the 76 Act because vested rights have arisen under it, and thereby limit the breadth of your argument closest to the copyright.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I think it's an interesting, it's a real problem. That's
I guess off the cuff, yeah, I'd be inclined to do that, just as a matter of prediction, not based on the logic of the Constitution, but just a guess. That seems quite likely. Question, like, why not the 76 Act? Some way of differentiating the suit from that would seem
desirable, and so far the 76 Act is retroactive in the same way. This one is the only plausible basis for differentiation.
Is this the second extension to any supplement?
Well, 1831 extended 1909.
No, I mean, with respect to any particular work, does this statute constitute the second retrospective?
For many works, it constitutes the third. Many words it constitutes the 11th retrospective.
Oh, actually, since 1831 straight through the
11th. From 1962 on, they had these series of short statutes. So there's the one that was extended in 1962. Class is extended in 1962.
Which is why we're 12 and 38.
The class is extended in 32 has been extended 11 times because it has, each time there's been an extension, been the class that's been extended as well as the other one.
And is the idea of repeated extensions of a particular work a relatively new phenomenon of what was happening prior to the 1831 statute? You got a one shot. You'll extend it and then never do it again. But the new habit seems to be actually, well, we give you an extension and send it to yet another and another. I mean, to me, if the risk is we have to support them with funds, the idea that Congress will be showing no good faith interest in not just every 10 years extending this particular work, that there's more of a problem.
I think that's a great point for two reasons. I think that's true. I'll have to do the numbers. I'm not sure whether it's true or not. But it brings out what really causes the problem here, which is, by rolling each class into the next, the number of interests that are affected by every extension increases dramatically. So by the time they get to 76, you've basically got 14 classes of copyrights who are all united in getting Congress, to extend the term of copyright once again. That's the only answer I can make. It's a focus of learning about that. It's not an argument we can make, but it's a public choice reason why there's this problem now, that there would have been if they never rolled one class into another.
But to keep along the lines of Barry and I were mentioning, I would emphasize that you know, assuming that days went into effect, so you don't have any, so you acted just as soon as you could.
Didn't come out in the discussion, the argument much, but I'd be worried about the Supreme Court has many times, when interpreting the copyright statute, suggested it has lots of purposes other than stimulating future productivity. Now, Mr. Emmer, you understandably, on these purposes, didn't adopt in your argument quite the same line as the government does in its brief here. In particular, the section B in the government's brief pushes this argument to be hard, and you apparently chose not to. The government's brief here argues that ensuring a fair return to the owners of subsisting copyrights is a constitutional basis for Congress to extend the terms of subsisting copyrights. We don't have to just limit ourselves to stimulating future productivity. If they're right about this, if the government's right about this, then the whole retroactivity argument, which is your strongest position, collapses. Now, if you chose the high road here to emphasize the ways in which this statute could be characterized as a stimulus for productivity. But there is this alternative route that the government could go down and say, well, Denise's line, but there are lots of other things going on. Fair return, and what about protecting artists' moral rights, the Visual Artists' Rights Act? You're not challenging that, presumably.
Uniformity,
right, the harmonization argument, a whole bunch of them. And the government can, if it wants to, point to a bunch of Supreme Court opinions where they intertwine a stimulus for creativity with fair return for artists. So you've got a tough road if this comes up. Your argument apparently has to be, well, we looked at the text of the Constitution, but then you have fair return, it's just it says the talk utilitarian language there. And to the extent other purposes have figured in subsequent Supreme Court opinions, it's been preamble, clause, dictum, hasn't really mattered. It's a little awkward, of course, the Supreme Court has taken this line pretty
enthusiastically
over that. I agree. And so what my thinking was, if you can frame the copyright clause for the requirement of necessary conditions of validity, originality, and satisfying the times, whether it's doing these other things or not, the purpose of that clause is to develop at least the original satisfied satisfying the times. And for purposes of the First Amendment, these are legitimate. These are interests that we might say the court could consider to be legitimate, but still we need to have a weighing of the intermediate scrutiny analysis, which there just was none of that in the court below.
So as a procedural matter, you're giving up your effort to secure victory at this point. You just want a trial. You want it to go back. You don't.
Well,
the procedural process is a little tricky here, right?
Yeah.
Are you going to argue?
You're really, you're in cross appeal. So all we had before us is the government's motion to dismiss.
Well, I mean,
you asked for summary judgment, they motion to dismiss, that was granted, you appealed the motion to dismiss. So I think that. That's not a problem for you. I think that's actually a
helpful. It keeps you alive.
Right. I mean, strategically, if we go back and forth and thinking about this, you know, we always want to ask for the smallest amount possible. And I think it's a huge victory just to get the intermediate scrutiny standard applied, not them saying, hey, go back and apply it. We have nothing in this record to figure it out. This was no show. Just go back and apply it. And then we'll have to argue in the lower court, and we'll have a chance to bring in real evidence about this. But that, it seems to me, even if we lost in the lower court and never got any higher, that at least would be a principle that's used in our society.
I want you to go down to Ms. Stanbury, yeah. You did a wonderful job, and I don't know whether your mark was in it or not.
Did you have some reactions as you were listening to the argument about where Larry was vulnerable or where he landed some very good blows, which you might sort of
I think that just looking at the cover, it seems to me pretty clear that you're right at this moment that this is an appeal of a motion to dismiss only before the D.C. Circuit. There's an interesting strategic question here as to whether you want to develop a factual record or not. There are so many, among which are what you said, Professor Fisher, about the other policies. So many interesting, factually debatable, underlying questions here that it may be, it's very hard for me to imagine a court deciding this case as a matter of law. Legal principles almost. I think a factual record is going to be necessary to establish that the limited time doctrine is in fact preservative of public domain and that's desirable in the context of copyright these days. So there's an interesting strategic question at the outset as to whether you back up a little bit and ask to have it sent back for you argue in that fashion. You argue that there are factual.
Of course, he doesn't have to be bankrupt. Only enough, we would say that we didn't cross the field, so right,
we have to pull out portions of the complaint where certain factual assertions are made that he was not allowed to prove, and that this court is bound by in the context of a motion to dismiss.
Well, that's good.
You don't have a different.
No.
I think that the more you emphasize the need for factual record. My instinct is more helping our students. Because in the end, what you're asking the court to do is to make an inquiry that even under Turner, I don't think we're going to satisfy the useful legal structure. Congress, the department spent days and months making up a bunch of economic data that various studies don't have to do. Charts and graphs to try and figure out what
they did. They did have a chart.
No, they did, but I don't think at the end of the day that was a model of what we want the structure document to look like. And even if you think of time, one of the reasons like such a relatively new case before decided that you know when it's a commercial test. It's a purely objective, almost test, either these are facts or they're not facts.
And the more that the court can understand the case is limited in that way, the more likely we're going to be. So my own take on it is to get them to think, look, this isn't about Congress versus the court making judgment about the public domain. It's not weighing the census. If there's a rule, you have to enact things only for limited time. And if it's retrospective, there's no way you can possibly be using limited time. You should have a per se rule that you cannot have retrospective extensions. There's no need for a factor.
So the big question is it doesn't work retroactively, it's just a gift.
Yeah, right, something like that. A principle like that, or in this case it's so egregious because there are heated instances and we have to consider all the other cases. But the idea that the way this case comes out is a weighing of the desire to protect the public domain against the need for incentives, and that somehow we have a trial that can get us any closer to figuring out what the answer is than we are after practice. My own sense is that that's a doctrine the court is going to be very, very afraid because there's no limiting principle. Every copyright case will require that exact trial to go again and again. And I just can't imagine the courts are going to be desiring that their first step, the just beginning, Vice could look a lot like Vice if you make it about a pure text that just looks flawed.
Well, I agree that that would be appealing to avoid that factual theory. I'm not sure, though, what the way to structure the argument is so that they jump on that appealing option. And I wonder whether the better way to get them to jump on that appealing option is to just hammer home the obvious First Amendment points that this is mediated view. I don't think it's about weighing public interest or the public domain versus copyright. I think it's just a First Amendment question of whether this is plausibly creating an incentive. It's not as big as the public domain question, but if it's painted in their mind that they either can choose one way that says, okay, we've got a simple trial, or if it's prophylactic simple rule that you're offering, avoid that whole need, that might be the inducement for them to take that prophylactic rule.
So I would say on that point that you want to emphasize the availability of the prophylactic rule. In other words, as a preventive right now, like the same inquiry the court's supposed to engage at every stage of, you know, the copyright clause, how much evidence it shows the person, how much evidence is further mentioned. There's no out from that inquiry. So you want to think that the court's somewhat serious.
So, which member, thank you for coming up from New York City, however, calling to do this judge, thank you for taking the time to read briefs and participate. Eric Eldred, thank you for coming down to see the room. We'll see you in Washington as well. We're going to try to get you a copy of the oral argument case from Thursday as well, and make that available and see how quickly they pass this. Judges and participants, we have to do a free lunch. It's yours for the for many of you, we'll see you in this very room in this afternoon. Of course, lunch is going to be thank you very much.
Yes.